Washington, it's the Inside Scoop, with all the news the government does not want you to know. Now, here's the host of the Inside Scoop, Congressional Attorney Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, and I used to work as an attorney in Congress, both for the House Judiciary Committee and the House Homeland Security Committee, before doing this show. I still have time to go back from time to time and to interview members of Congress, and recently I had that opportunity at the Take Back America convention, a group of progressives that were meeting in Washington, D.C. At that time, I got to ask some tough questions to a number of members of Congress, those sitting in Congress, those who used to be, and those who will likely be. The ones I interviewed first was progressive Democratic member Jan Schakowsky of Illinois. Now, she's one of my favorites. You'll hear in the interview, I ask her many very tough questions. I think she gives some good answers. I then go on and interview Donna Edwards. Those of you that live in suburban Maryland know that she upturned the seat of Al Wynn, former Democrat, showing, I think, that progressive Democrats can win over more staid Democrats. Then I'm going to interview Tom Andrews, former congressman of Maine. He's now chairman of the Win Without War Foundation, about what the Democrats can do to get us out of Iraq. And finally, a tough interview with Chairman John Conyers of the Judiciary Committee, a former boss of mine, if you will. And I ask him tough questions about what the Democrats can do to hold the administration accountable. Sit back, enjoy the interviews. If you want to call in and comment on them, you can do so. Let me start with Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky of Illinois.
Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Happy to be back.
Yeah, you've been here, I think, three or four times
on my program. Yeah.
And I always appreciate when you come. You always tell our listeners the truth about what's going on,
even when
it's not very pleasant. Let me ask you this. The good news, of course, the Democrats have been in control for a year now. Mm-hmm. We've been waiting in the wilderness for all this time. How much have we accomplished in that first year? What do you think have we accomplished, and what do you think we have yet to do?
Well, look, the Democrats in control have done a lot, particularly in the House of Representatives. We held the president accountable on domestic spying. We passed minimum wage. We passed some important legislation on energy. In the House, we actually set a timeline. Well, actually, it went to the president. He vetoed it.
Right.
A timeline to get out of Iraq. I don't want to be whiny about it, but it is hard to have a real working majority in the Senate since they've filibustered everything and required 60 votes. And then we still have a president, I do think, probably the worst in the history of our country, that vetoes everything good that we send to him. So it's been pretty hard.
I'll tell you, a lot of activists, a lot of progressives, I have to say they're complaining about the Democrats. Now, maybe it's because we had such high hopes, but it seems that, for example, on the subpoenas. We hold them in contempt, that's great, but then we are going to do a court proceeding, and that may take till the end of their term. There is an inherent process to hold the Harriet Myers and so forth in contempt. Is that something the House is considering?
Well, we are considering that, but it is not a small thing to pass a resolution for contempt of Congress. And we have subpoenaed a number of people, and we are exposing the fact that there are war profiteers. Henry Waxman has been amazing in holding this administration accountable. We've gotten a fair amount of information. And, you know, the thing is, after this administration, if there have been high crimes and misdemeanors, if laws have been broken, they can still be held accountable.
Even after their
Absolutely, absolutely. A crime is a crime. And I think that, you know, we've seen a number of things. I'm on the Intelligence Committee now. You know, I think we have to explore whether or not the law was followed when domestic surveillance was done.
The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act amendments, what the president is trying to do, it seems, is to retroactively legalize all his law-breaking from beforehand.
The thing that's absolutely crazy in the debate on FISA, I'm very proud of the House of Representatives.
But we fear that you're not going to stand firm. A lot of Democrats are afraid you're going to cave.
The Senate sounds like it's amenable to our notion of saying that they can go to court, that even though the president wants to claim state secrets, that we would set up a secret court so that they could defend themselves against the charge of just handing over all of our information. But here's the thing. The Republicans talk about the phone companies as some sort of hero, good Samaritans,
right,
they're calling
right,
them,
right.
And that Do you think most Americans think that the telephone companies are good Samaritans?
No.
I don't.
No.
I mean, you know, they take our money and now they want our civil liberties. I really don't think so.
I don't think the telephone companies are behind this. I think Bush is asking them to spy on Americans and they're saying, sure, but they're just a conduit.
They are, but not all the telephone companies. Quest actually said no to the president. And we want them. They said, well, we have to get this information right away. Well, actually, we want the telephone companies to think twice. We want them to make sure that these are legal requests before they start turning over all the information about phone calls, et cetera, that we're making.
I have to tell you, I've been personally quite harsh on some of the Democratic colleagues in the Senate. My Senator Jim Webb voted for the FISA bill that the president wanted. He voted for some good amendments, but when they failed, he voted for the bill to begin with. I've been after him. A lot of people have been after him. And I got to tell you, you surprised us in the House in a good way.
Absolutely.
A lot of Democrats really thought you were going to cave, and you didn't. And you stood firm,
you know,
and we want to see you do more of it.
And I was so proud of Nancy Pelosi and our leadership, who basically said, look, we are not going to cave into this fear-mongering. When the FISA bill didn't pass the way the president wanted it, it's not as if we were suddenly exposed to terrorist attacks.
We already have a secret court, the FISA court.
We do have a FISA court. You can get that information. You can even get the information before you get approval of the court if it's a real emergency. So they have all the tools. That is a fake thing that this administration doesn't have the tools. Fear. Fear that they will be accused of somehow allowing the terrorists to go after Americans. And you know, once again, going along with this fear-mongering of the administration.
When Nancy Pelosi stood up to them, there was a big, oh my God, what have we done? It seemed like Democrats were looking all around, will America be mad at us? And Americans weren't. They got it.
Although I do have to say, you know, some of my colleagues did go home to ads that were run by the their Republican opponents,
sure,
and by the Republican National Committee, accusing them of not being strong enough. I don't think it has either.
So
and that's
I'm hoping
such an important
now that the
lesson.
Senate Democrats, the 17 of them that voted the wrong way, maybe we can peel them back some.
Well, Senator Rockefeller, who's chair of the Intelligence Committee.
I'm not a fan.
But I want to tell you something.
The Judiciary Committee did it right in the Senate. Rockefeller didn't, and Reid went with
But he has said some positive things about the way the House handled it. And so I am hoping that I'm hoping that that's the way it's going to resolve itself, that the Senate will go along with the House version. You know, and this should not be a partisan issue anyway, by the way. I mean, I think real conservatives do not want Big Brother poking into their business and knowing everything about them, want the Constitution to protect their civil liberties and keep the government at bay. And so I'm hoping that that will prevail as well. I mean, that notion in the country.
Let me give you the criticism, and let me be very clear. No one's criticizing you.
I don't take it personally.
You have been steadfast in this, and really, I can say just from my experience working on the Hill, you've always been steadfast for progressive causes.
Thank you. Yeah,
But the fear is, you look at the FISA bill, and here Harry Reid had a choice. You had the Senate Judiciary Committee bill, which was a great bill. It was like the House Restore Act. It was a solid bill, protected civil liberties. Or you had Senator Rockefeller's bill that did what the president wanted to do. And he made a choice. And here you had the leader of the Democrats make a choice that the majority of Democrats in the Senate didn't want. He went with the minority of Democrats, what Rockefeller wanted. The fear is, honestly, that Harry Reid in particular, and to some extent Nancy Pelosi, I hear the criticism. Personally, I more blame Reid, are not being as firm as the people that have elected them to office.
Well, I think there is a feeling that the public is ahead of members of Congress. But we do have a very diverse caucus. I think Nancy Pelosi, and, you know, let's remember, the House of Representatives did pass a strong bill about a withdrawal from Iraq. You know, I mean, we've done some very important, and I think courageous things. You know, it's very hard because some of that money does, in fact, go to the troops. I mean, I have not wanted to send any more money to Iraq, but we have to have a redeployment plan to bring them home. Use the money just for that. You know, we have some new candidates that are running for Congress right now that have put together a group. There's 10 of them right now, maybe more. who have a responsible plan for pulling out of Iraq. Donna Edwards is one, Darcy Bruner from Washington State. There's 10 of them from around the country. And there are going to be more that do that. So, you know, I think you're going to see a very refreshing change in the Congress. But I think what's going to be key is that we're going to expand our majority. We're going to have more senators, more Democrats. And hopefully, I pray, I'm working hard for Barack Obama, that we'll have a Democratic president of the United States.
It's going to take that, isn't it? We're never going to get out of Iraq in the last 9 months of George Bush's term.
Well,
not even start.
Well, he says that, now they're rethinking pulling back from the surge, which they claim to be so effective. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. But John McCain, I mean, it will just kill me if he were to win. He's talking about 100 years, 1,000 years, whatever, that we're going to be in Iraq, just endless war. And, you know, this war is not only costing us almost 4,000 lives, we'll hit that horrible landmark pretty soon. $13 million an hour.
$13 million an hour.
An hour.
How many trillions have we
24/7.
And
the projections are, when you're taking everything into account, that it could be $3 trillion. I can't think about that. But I can think about $13 million. I'm used to thinking about that. That's every hour. Think about schools. Think about all the roads and bridges, you know, that are falling apart.
$100,000 a second.
Yeah, I mean,
in Iraq, it's stunning.
It is so stunning.
You've endorsed Barack Obama.
I have.
The President of the United States. You think he's the best able to beat John McCain better than Hillary Clinton?
I absolutely do think
so.
I think the contrast. Well, I think the war is one good reason, and it's because Barack Obama is about the future and not about the past, and that we have to reintroduce John McCain to the American people. I mean, this has been
the
absolute
maverick. They say he's not that bad. He's a moderate Republican. What's the real John McCain?
Well, I mean, I think John McCain, if you look at the real record, that he's been tying himself closer and closer to the Bush administration, to the right wing of his party. I've met some women who think that he's pro-choice, opposite, and he's absolutely anti-choice. I say to people who might be thinking about, I say Supreme Court, a whole generation that would be affected by those appointments. And I just think that we absolutely have an opportunity to have a transformative, we could be on the brink of a new progressive era in this country right now.
Why is Obama the right person to go forward? I happen to like Hillary Clinton and Obama a lot, both of them. I did endorse Obama, like yourself, but I'm asking you the questions.
Yeah.
Why? Because there are still a lot of people, a lot of women, a lot of people who feel that Hillary Clinton's been there longer, Barack Obama's still kind of new on the scene.
I've known Barack Obama for 12 years. I served with him in the House in Illinois when he was in the Senate. So I actually saw his capacity to work, I call it his magic, in bringing people of different views together to the same table.
Illinois.
He took on not easy issues, but he took on hard issues like the death penalty. You know, Illinois had 13 people on death row who were perfectly innocent. We had to do something about it. But most politicians actually run away from that issue. We made some changes. We have a moratorium on the death penalty, but also now we videotape all interrogations. So he took on very tough issues that people don't like. Well, particularly the interrogations. There's some different requirements in terms of adequate representation of people in capital crimes. He took on the issue of racial profiling. He did help to get 150,000 more of our children. This is while he was a Democrat in a Republican majority. And one of his colleagues, Republican colleagues, has done an ad for him saying,
really?
This is a guy we can work with. Yeah, absolutely. And so I think that's what we need. People long for that right now, getting past the finger-pointing and the backbiting and the divisiveness and on to solutions to the problems.
But the finger-pointing and backbiting continues. We have Fox News talking about his preacher, Jeremiah Wright. I understand that Barack Obama is going to give a major speech.
He gave a major speech that I think is historic, because he dealt with the issue of race, the wounds that white, black, and brown Americans have, and talked about how he understands that one election isn't going to solve that problem, but it is a place to begin. He disassociated himself with the most, that replay over and over and over again.
And
you know, awful, awful things that were said, and he agreed, and he totally disagrees with those. But
now, the Republicans use this all the way to November?
No, I don't. I really think that what he said today about how all of us, even his white grandmother, would admitted to him at one point that she was afraid of black men on the street. The depth in our souls in this country of racism that often we don't even acknowledge, that he said, but we have to acknowledge it and talk about it. It was just, it was an amazing, amazing speech. And he says, what, am I going to disown one of the women I love most in life and in the world, my grandmother? And while I'm not going to disown Reverend Wright, we also have to understand the generational factors of racism for a person like that. At
sure,
the same
he's
time,
racism. He's angry about it.
Right? And the anger right. that white people have, as well as black people have, as well as brown people have. We have to understand that, and we have to disassociate. You know, to try and deal with it. And he certainly disassociated himself from the remarks. It was really, I think, the best speech I've ever heard on the topic.
I can't wait to hear it. I'm going to be playing it for my listeners. Congresswoman Schakowsky, every time I have you on the air, every single time, I'm more and more impressed.
Oh,
I
thank
ask you.
You
tough questions.
Thank you.
And you come away with so many great, heartfelt responses.
Thank you.
I love having you here on the Inside Scoop. Please come back often.
Oh, I will.
And
you know.
I understand they're honoring you today for your support of progressive causes right here at Take Back America.
Yeah, yeah,
I
I'm
can't think of
it.
Anyone
thank you.
Who deserves the honor more. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Well, you heard what Congresswoman Schakowsky had to say. She said that the Senate was acting out of fear. You hear that, Senator Webb? Why can't you act out of your best judgment instead of out of fear? I'm hoping you do better on that FISA bill. But as Congresswoman Schakowsky said, the public is ahead of members of Congress, and I think she's right. And I don't know if you could tell on the screen, but she was wearing a Barack Obama button. The next person I interview is a soon-to-be Congresswoman, Donna Edwards of Maryland. She beat Al Wynn in a primary that was very closely watched, is likely to win the overwhelmingly Democratic district. Here she discusses how she was able to take on the establishment and take it down.
I'm talking now with, I guess, one of the amazing heroes so far of calendar year 2008. This is Donna Edwards. She's the Democratic nominee for the 4th, I think, Congressional District in Maryland. She did something that I think all of us dream about and think can't possibly be done. She took on a sitting incumbent of her own party, Al Wynn, someone who'd been there for 12 years, I think?
Well, actually 16.
16 years. A very long time. In a district where he had everything going for him. He had the patronage, he had a whole group of people supporting him. And Donna Edwards took a grassroots campaign and in a Democratic primary unseated Al Wynn. How the heck did you do that?
Well, I tell you, it really is amazing. We won with 60% of the vote. It was an overwhelming
60% of the vote.
An overwhelming victory. And it was a victory really for progressives of all stripes.
She's been talking so much about it that she's really hoarse. So understand, but she's doing very good. Go ahead.
But from labor unions like the SEIU and our garment workers and hotel workers and our grocery store workers to environmental groups, the League of Conservation Voters.
But didn't Al Wynn have all those
organizations?
At the beginning? I mean, he was a Democrat. He'd been there for 16 years. Why did he lose them?
He lost them because we started taking a look at his record. And when you vote for the oil and gas companies in the Bush-Cheney energy bill, you're going to lose environmentalists. When you vote for the banks and the credit card companies for bankruptcy reform that really just empowers the banks and credit card companies, you're going to lose consumers. When you vote for Tira Schiavo, and then you're going to lose women.
I don't understand this. A guy is elected. He was, at least at the beginning, my understanding, was a good Democrat. He supported progressive principles. What happens when someone comes to Washington, they go to Congress, and they start, how do they lose all their values? Is it campaign donations? Is that what's going on here? I mean, because people wonder, we get all these bright-eyed, bushy-tailed Democrats. I hope you're not this way in 16 years, Donna Edwards. But it seems that we elect these Democrats, we believe in them strongly, they get into power, and then they're always disappointing us.
You know, I think there really is a component that really has to do with the role of money in politics. Taking money from every industry, corporate special interest money, and over time it really does begin to weigh on public policy. And we could see that with Congressman Wynn. And we pointed to his record in order to defeat them. defeat him. And, you know, I didn't take any corporate special interest money.
How did you have enough money to run against him?
Because I reached out to real people, to ordinary people who were willing to, you know, send a check for $2 or $10 or $100. Individuals, thousands and thousands of them. I think we had something like 15,000 donors from around the country.
How did you do it? What's the secret? Is it knocking on doors? Is it going on a website? I mean, how do... When you take on the established interests, it seems they have all the money, they have all the power, they have all the endorsements. Even, you know, if they, he's been a Democrat for 16 years, probably the Democratic Party was largely behind him, even if he wasn't supporting most of our values. How do you take him on?
Well, you know, it's the good old-fashioned grassroots campaign, knocking on doors, making telephone calls, using the internet, which is a new tool that we have to organize and to advocate. And we put all of those pieces together because it wasn't one piece alone. It was all these pieces together. And more than that, it was our progressive fabric that we pulled together that made the difference. And so I feel, you know, I feel like the voters have my back.
Oh, well,
I'm not
totally
afraid to go to the United States Congress.
Oh, absolutely, they have your back.
To have some courage.
But if you turn on us 10 years from now, we're going to knock you out too. You know that.
Sure.
Okay.
That's right.
That's fair. Now, one of your big issues was getting the troops out of Iraq. Was there a difference between you and our women on that?
Well, you know, the congressman had supported the original authorization to go to war in Iraq in a heavily Democratic district that did not support that resolution. And we called attention to that because most of our voters didn't know that he voted for the war. And then he continued to support it over and over again, and then finally when he was called out on it, he stepped away and began to vote to defund the war. It was too little, too late.
Now, winning the Democratic primary in your district, let's face it, it's tantamount to winning the election. I don't think there are too many Republicans in your district. So you do have the voters at your back. What can you do as, let's face it, a freshman member of Congress come January 20, 2009, hopefully with a Democratic president? I've endorsed Barack Obama, but even if it's Hillary Clinton, hopefully with a Democratic president at your doorstep. But what can you, as a new member of Congress, even do to affect real people's lives in your district?
Well, I've endorsed Senator Obama as well, and so I'm looking forward to serving President Obama.
That would be great.
But I'm already starting to do some of those things that I can do. And one is I've actually joined with a group of progressive challengers around the country, candidates, who signed on to a responsible plan to end the war in Iraq. And we say
is it like Obama's plan? Or?
It is. We have all the tools, the legislative tools, military, diplomatic, you know, tools, economic tools to get out of Iraq. And it takes the political will to do that. And so as challengers, we know what our mandate is going in. And so we're not going to be confused in January 2009. And we're going to have President Obama's back in the United States Congress when it comes to really getting our troops out of Iraq, doing what's right by the Iraqi people, protecting our national security, and taking care of our troops.
Well, you know, John McCain says that if we get out of Iraq, we won't be protecting our national security. He says there'll be a bloodbath, Al-Qaeda will take over Iraq. I know maybe people in your district don't think that, but there are plenty of people in America who do think that. How do you respond?
Well, I think our challenge as progressives is actually articulate a vision of national security that embraces the concept that we have to have diplomatic relations around the world, that we have to have a strong military force, but use it wisely and scarcely, and that understands that we have to engage other partners in the region with Iraq to bring about security at the behest of the Iraqi people. That's real national security. That's looking out for our interests. That's protecting our troops. And I will stand up, you know, with John McCain or others like him, and offer an alternative vision for national security that recognizes that we have a special obligation also to our troops on the ground.
I tell you, it's as Obama said, he's not against all wars, he's just against dumb wars.
Well, this one was a dumb war.
It certainly was, and I hope you can end it. And I just want to congratulate you. Personally, I've been watching your campaign. I don't live in Maryland. I live in Virginia. But just watching your campaign and seeing you take on the established interest and win, I don't know, it just... It gives heart, I think, to anyone who's ever taken on a power and won. So,
well, you know,
congratulations again.
Believe, and yes, we can.
Yes, we can. Thanks again for coming on the Insights.
Thank you.
Well, you've heard from a sitting congresswoman and a soon-to-be sitting congresswoman. Coming up from the break, we'll hear from former Congressman Tom Andrews, who believes he's doing something far more important than sitting in Congress, and that is the president of Win Without War, working hard not only to bring our troops home from Iraq, but setting a new paradigm for how we can fight our enemies, but but do so without war. Back with the interview with Tom Andrews and then Chairman of the Judiciary Committee, John Conyers, right after this.
How far would you go to help someone? Would you go to the end of your driveway? Would you cross a street? Would you cross an ocean? To a place 6,000 miles from home? And how long would you go? Would you go for a week? A month? A year? Would you go for 2 years? Would you go if you could use your knowledge to teach someone, and in the process, maybe learn something yourself? Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps.
James, don't forget your helmet.
Will do.
Not your helmet.
Your bike helmet.
Oh, okay.
Hi. I'm James Thrash with the Washington Redskins. On the football field, a helmet is an important piece of equipment. I also wear another helmet that's just as important, a bike helmet. It's the most important piece of equipment you'll have the next time you're out on your bike. Wear yours and make sure your kids do too. Safety first with the Skins.
Monica and her friends want you to know that you should never get near a dog when it is eating, playing with a favorite toy, or sleeping. It's really important to make time for exercise and games and keep your dog's vaccines up to date. Never leave a dog in a small, confined space. This can make dogs aggressive like Monica. If you follow this advice, you and your dog can play safely and happily together.
We are back to the Inside Scoop. Call in live and let your voice be heard. Here again, your host, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I've been playing my interviews with members of Congress, Democrats who, let's face it, some Democrats are unhappy with. They think they're not doing enough. Well, here's a Democrat that no longer serves in Congress but is working hard outside of Congress to try to change the paradigm for when we go to war. Here's my interview with former Congressman Tom Andrews of Maine.
Was in Congress. But you're not in Congress anymore.
I'm not.
You are now the director of the National Win Without War campaign.
That's right. It's a coalition. It's a 40-member coalition, very diverse, from Move On to NAACP to the Sierra Club to the National Organization for Women to the National Council of Churches, a wide and broad group that have various priorities as organizations, but they've all come together. We've all come together because we realize just how important this issue is, national security issue is, the Iraq issue is, and unless we can get this right in 2008, any and every American agenda is going to be in peril.
Tom, are you a Democratic superdelegate?
No.
You're not. Have you made an endorsement in this campaign?
Well, I'm supporting Barack Obama.
Okay, well, good, because that segues very nicely into my next question. Barack Obama has said, and he's been criticized by some, that he would be willing to meet with anybody. He'd be willing to meet with a national leader, with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran, or with, I guess, just about anyone, Hugo Chavez. And some have said that that's not a good idea, to dignify these dictators by meeting with them. And what's your response on that?
Well, you just have to take a look and see where we are right now as a result of the view and the policy to do just the opposite of what Senator Obama is calling for us to do. Terrorist attacks since the president announced his national security strategy of unilateralism and militarism have shot through the roof. We know that Osama bin Laden, for example, is alive and well right now as we speak, training, plotting, his command and control structure has been completely reconstituted. And this is all as a result. The deteriorating conditions, security conditions for the United States and the world, the isolation of the United States and the world, the enormous anti-Americanism around the world at record numbers is precisely because of this arrogant attitude that we can go it alone. We don't have to talk to our friends, let alone our enemies, and the idea that we would engage in negotiation, with discussion, with opening up dialogue is so critical to dealing with these issues.
Well, let me ask you about something you said. You said that terrorist attacks have gone up. Now, George Bush is telling me every single day on the television, we're fighting over there in Iraq so you don't have to fight them here. He says we haven't had an attack since September 11th. He never mentions anthrax. I don't know why. Maybe he forgets. But is he right or are you right?
Well, he is. Well, just look at the facts. I mean, let's just look. You know, you can't debate facts. I mean, the fact is that there are more terrorists today than ever before.
How do we know that?
Because you look at our own government. You look at the National Intelligence Estimate. You look at the CIA. I mean, the CIA testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee just a few years ago, and then every year since, we've seen in the National Intelligence Estimate that terrorism is on the rise, that our policy, specifically Iraq, is one of the single most important breeding grounds of terrorism, a cause celeb, as they say, and I'm quoting them, for Osama bin Laden. So we know that this is having the effect of more terrorist attacks, more fatalities, and you only have to look to our own government to get those facts.
Well, now, Bush's argument seems to be, and it's a weird one, that if we send 160,000 troops to Iraq, that they will act as a magnet, and all the terrorists will go there and kill our troops rather than killing Americans at home. And, I don't know, if I were a soldier, I wouldn't really like that idea, but that's... That's his argument, I think.
Yeah, kind of makes you feel good about everything, doesn't it? You know, and the fact that we add 30,000 more troops in to try to create some stability, so that there is political space for the ultimate answer to this debacle, which is political reconciliation and compromise among the major factions that are at war with each other in Iraq. And what's happened is just the opposite. There has been not a single stretch of progress in any of the areas that we were promised that progress would occur.
That's not what John McCain says. He says the surge is working.
Yeah, and he says there's political progress. But the problem is he can't provide us with any evidence whatsoever. As a matter of fact, there have been three specific attempts over the past year and a half in which the administration, along with the Maliki government, has tried to make it look as if there was the progress. A supposed oil revenue distribution law. The great fanfare. Nothing happened. Didn't go anywhere.
It wasn't passed.
It wasn't passed. But the media attention that it received made Americans think it had passed.
Because someone wrote a law.
Precisely. And then they could use that to say there's political progress. The debathification law. What was that?
Right. I heard that in the news.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. We're going to have debathification. Turns out that the actual law is... proposed law is worse than this than the current status. In other words, they would throw more Baathists out of positions, even the lowest level positions, clerks, in many areas of life, and particularly in the key ministries in Iraq, with this new law. So it actually made things worse, not better.
So we were just being lied to on that one.
Yeah, we were. And then there's been more. I mean, so we just continue. We heard, for example, 4 weeks ago, that a new law was passed to establish a constitution so that there could be local elections in those areas where vast majority of Sunnis that are being ruled over by Shia local leaders, they'd have a chance to do something about it.
That sounds good.
Sounds very good, particularly in the areas that are the most volatile.
Sure.
Most violent. Okay, wow, we're going to have this law.
Sounds great.
Wow, we're going to have these elections. Nothing happened. It was vetoed by the presidential council, and now
Maliki did it. Well, he's the prime minister.
He's the prime minister. No, it was the presidential council that his allies in the presidential council vetoed it, and now we're learning from just about everybody inside of Iraq, there is no way on God's green earth anything like that is going to happen in the foreseeable future.
What you're saying is not on my news channel. I'm not seeing this on CNN. All I hear about is progress.
That's correct. And, of course, the only progress we've had is the progress of deception. Again, it was a systematic use of deception that got us into Iraq. And now the systematic use of deception is being used to keep us in Iraq.
Is that one of the reasons why Admiral Fallon is gone? Because he was a truth teller?
Yeah, I think so. You know, talk to General Shinseki, who told the Congress what it was going to cost. Before the invasion of Iraq. I mean, he was summarily dismissed, ridiculed by the administration.
What should be the United States' stance toward Iran?
We should be willing to engage, in fact, open up dialogue with the regime in Iran without preconditions, particularly the precondition of the administration.
Well, wouldn't it be better if we talked with Khamenei, the guy that's really in charge, rather than this clown, Ahmadinejad?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that the Bush administration's policy is empowering Ahmadinejad. I mean, the economy of that country is in the toilet. Corruption has never been as high as it is. People are just fed up. And the reason that he was elected in the first place was because of his promise to deal with those two issues. So his numbers go way, 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 way down. And what happens? We start saber-rattling. He takes the nationalistic card out and begins to get more politically popular. So his base now is political base is sustained by his defense of the nation against the attacks coming from George Bush and the United States. So we are empowering him while we're marginalizing the reformers in Iran, and because we don't talk to him. I mean, that becomes...
But if we talk with him, doesn't that make him look better in the eyes of his people? He was harsh against the United States, and we talked to him anyway. Isn't the mere talking to him a propaganda victory?
If we did two things, if we agreed to sit down and begin negotiations, open talks with the regime, and secondly, if we took a preemptive military strike off of the table, be very clear about that, that we're not going to have a preemptive military strike, then two of the most important weapons that he has in his propaganda effort within Iran about the United States and condemning the United States is taken away from him.
But then he declares victory, right? Then he says, my saber rattling worked. America is no longer a military threat, and they're meeting with me, and that just proves that saber rattling works.
So then why do we have to continue to saber rattle? If the United States is willing to engage with us, if this military threat is off the table, then perhaps we don't have to be thinking about building up our weapons, focusing our entire national security strategy and foreign policy, that is the Iranian foreign policy, on defending against the United States attack. Let's take it off the table. Let's talk about the core issues that can actually build some bridges as opposed to divisions.
How about Hugo Chavez? What would you do about him?
Listen, I think that Senator Obama's view that the United States has blown it in terms of its foreign policy by isolating and not engaging is exactly correct. And I think that, you know, whether you like him or not, this is a figure who's extremely influential, who has enormous resources. And if you look at the price of oil, those resources are going up by the minute. We have to engage. We have to find common ground. You know, you don't have to talk to your friends as much as you have to talk to your enemies. And when you're talking about the stakes as high as they are, particularly in that region of the world with this enormous amount of wealth and power, it's irresponsible for us not to be engaging with Chavez.
I wonder if we could do it. I've often thought about this issue because I guess I'm somewhere in between Clinton and Obama on this particular issue. I agree absolutely that we've got to engage our enemies. We've got to talk with them. We've got to see what we can have in common. I absolutely agree with that. But I also understand some of what Hillary Clinton was saying about there is a propaganda victory simply by president meets with our guy. And I'm wondering whether we can't engage, but maybe not give them that propaganda victory. Either do it in private or at a lower level. I mean, clearly the Bush administration, they don't engage at all.
Right.
But I wonder if you think that maybe that might be the way to go. In other words, don't give them the photos that they can pass around with whatever they put on their own news, because it isn't a free news source, to say, hey, you know, we've talked down the president. In other words, engage with them, but maybe not so publicly. What do you think?
You know, when we say engage, I mean, the public diplomacy is many things, including the levels of diplomacy that you're just talking about. I mean, I don't believe that Senator Obama was saying that the day he is sworn into office, he's going to pick up the phone and call President Chavez. Quite the contrary. He's going to start engaging, and that process begins on all levels. And, of course, the President of the United States is responsible for one of those levels. But the fact is, if we indicate to the world that either we're too arrogant to engage or we're afraid of engaging, you know, what does that tell? I mean, they are getting as much of a propaganda victory by being able to demonize us because of that irresponsible stand than they would the other way around. And if we did engage them, well, then we have the stage and we can engage them on terms that would promote the principles, values, and objectives that we should be promoting on the world stage and take away from them their capacity to demonize us. Yes, within their own country, you control the media. There's, you know, very limited that we can do, but there's nothing we can do about that anyway. Let's instead engage them directly, find opportunities. You know, and I find also that within regimes, you know, these are not just unitary blocks. There are several elements within these regimes. If we can find openings within those elements, create some political space, we're going to be able to make progress. But you can't do that unless you're willing to take the step and make the risk of engagement.
I find it amazing, and people never talk about it, that before Ahmadinejad, they had a relatively moderate elected president of Iran, Khatami, who was, you know, he certainly supported his country, but by Iranian standards, by American standards, he was a moderate guy. We totally ignored him. And then we got, obviously, a lot worse.
No, that's exactly right. And, you know, you look at Iraq, and if there's any country in the world that has an interest in a stable, democratic Iraq, you know, it's Iran. I mean, the most powerful, popular political figure in all of Iraq is Iranian.
But don't they want to control Iraq? I mean, if we leave, I know that you advocate, I'm sure, like Obama and Clinton, that we leave, whether it's within a year or 16 months. When we're gone, the two things that you hear are going to happen. It's either there'll be massive civil war, people killing each other, maybe even genocide between Shia and Sunni, or you create an Iranian client state. Is that true?
No. I mean, listen, this is a very complex situation. And as far as as long as the United States is seen as a military occupier, Iran has no interest. And simultaneously is saying, you're next, pal. What interest do they have in trying to do anything other than allowing
us
exactly to continue in Iraq? But once that changes, and once that dynamic changes, suddenly everything changes. And it's suddenly in Iran's interest to have a stable and secure democracy.
Yeah, they have a huge civil war there. That can't be good for Iran. There'd be massive refugees and trouble on their border.
Can't be good. That's right.
They don't want civil war.
Right. And if it's a democracy, listen, it's a majority Shia. Now, of course, it's complex. There are, again, Shia is not one monolithic bloc. There are many types of Shias and so forth. But they have, for them, it's certainly not in their interest for there to be a war within Iraq. There's certainly not in their interest to have millions of refugees heading over their border. It certainly is in their interest to have a stable, functioning democracy. And of course they're going to try to exert a sphere of influence in Iraq.
And so will Saudi Arabia for the Sunnis and Jordan. So it actually would be a balance of power anyway.
That's correct. So what are we so afraid of? We've seen what's happened with this unilateralism and militarism and not talking to anyone. Why don't we give an alternative a try and see what
here's
happens.
What we're afraid of. We're afraid that if they control their own oil, we won't get as much of it. Congressman, you know that.
Oh, you think oil might have something to do with this?
I'm just guessing, because it wasn't weapons of mass destruction, and it wasn't Al-Qaeda, and it wasn't democracy. So what about that? What about, let's just be purely imperialist here, all right? Admit the truth, which they never will. We invaded for oil. We're not doing such a good job of it right now because they keep bombing the oil supply centers. But if we leave Iraq, doesn't Iran get their oil supplies? Isn't that how it works?
You have, basically, it's a principle of self-interest. You have an enormous amount of oil sitting underneath Iraq. Iraq is going to put that oil on the world market. It has every interest to do so. And, that's the way it works. And that's what will happen. They'll cut deals in terms of the refining and development and so forth. It may be with Iran. It may be with Shell. I don't know. But the fact is that it's in their interest to develop that oil and put it on the world market, and we'll have access to that oil on the world market.
Now, John McCain says that we can be in Iraq 100 years, but it doesn't necessarily have to be violent for 100 years, that we're toning it down with the surge, and it'll be just like Germany and Japan and South Korea, and we'll have peace and goodness, and everyone will hold hands and sing and
Kumbaya.
Have flowers.
Kumbaya. Yeah,
exactly. Why is he wrong?
Well, it reflects a fundamental misunderstanding of what Iraq has meant to that region of the world and to people like Osama bin Laden. It means that he hasn't read his own national intelligence estimates and CIA testimony before the Senate Select Committee. This is a cause celeb. This is fueling international terrorism. And the fact that if the United States is there in any shape, form, or manner, the way we are there now, we're perceived as a military occupier in this Islamic state, and that is going to fuel this network of international terrorism and destabilize that region. The only way we can remain in Iraq should be as a partner with international, the Arab League, the United Nations, those entities that would be able to truly provide some security, but also the assurance that this is not a function of military power by the United States but because it's truly a function of trying to create international stability.
If we get our troops out of Iraq, should we put more into Afghanistan or into border areas, even a Pakistan with Afghanistan?
I think, you know, that's where the real threat to the United States comes. It's in Afghanistan and it's in Pakistan. And I think we need to do, again...
So you're not against all military action.
No, I'm not.
You're not a pacifist. You think that we need troops, and that may be a place we need them.
Well, that's right. I mean, I supported the original attack. Not every member of our coalition did. I want to hasten to add this. But, you know, we cannot afford not to win in Afghanistan.
That's self-defense. They attacked us.
No, exactly. It is self-defense. We know Osama bin Laden is at large right now. We know he's planning his next attack. We just can't tolerate that. But that said, we need to have a fundamentally different strategy to deal with it, in which our military power is not in the lead. But we have, you know, Senator Joe Biden said this a few weeks ago. He's proposed a Marshall Plan for Afghanistan, for Pakistan. He's talked about a...
We've got to get rid of Mubarak, right? I mean, they elected...
that's right.
The voters threw him out, and he hasn't gone yet.
That's exactly right. And give the new government a fighting chance. And he's talking about a democracy dividend, $1 billion for a new government committed to democracy. And look at the support that we provided, the billions of dollars that we provided to Pakistan. Where has that gone? Has that gone to help the quality of life of the average
Pakistani? I assume it's gone to Mubarak's strongman.
It's gone to a strongman, and it's gone to deal with, defense-wise, India. I mean, that's where that money's been pouring into. So we need to have a fundamentally different frame and focus and strategy in dealing with Pakistan and Afghanistan, led by what, you know, development aid, led by changing the terms of the debate and our relationship. And yes, military has a component. We can't allow these very, very dangerous people to be hanging around at large, being able to plot the overthrow. But we also need to take away the sphere of influence of these individuals, and we can do that through the fundamental change in our policy.
One more country in the Middle East. We had just recently Hamas in Gaza raining missiles down on Israel, Israel responding strongly, finally. What should the United States policy be towards Israel, towards a Palestinian state? What can we do to bring peace to that region that's different from what we're doing now?
Wow, how much time do we have on this?
tell you what, as long as you want, and then you got to go.
I got to go. Listen, there is, I've said at the outset of our conversation that there is no, one of the first steps, obviously, to changing our policy is to get out of Iraq. I think that's extremely important. I also think we have to engage Iran. I think we have to renounce terrorism and end terrorism. We have to close Guantanamo Bay. We have to take away all the propaganda
tools.
Stop
torture. Stop extraordinary rendition. Stop.
Exactly. All of those things. But in addition to that, we need to have a very serious, a very focused, and a very sustained effort to bring peace to the Middle East, to deal with this horrendous situation that is in no one's interest to continue to maintain. And it just, frankly, has not been a priority of this administration. And as a result of that, you know, the end of the administration comes, they're trying.
Now they're trying, right? Now they're trying. Right. 7 years into it.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's completely, to me, it's absurd and it's ridiculous. And you have, again, the Palestinians are not a monolith. There are elements there.
There's a big difference between Hamas and the PA, for example.
No, precisely. And you know, we need to be a resource. We need to be a broker. We need to be willing to take risks in engaging all sides to bring them to the table and to create a peace. But unless we do that, unless we can have a fair and just peace, in which Israel's security is assured, in which the hopes and aspirations of the Palestinians are met. Unless that happens, this is going to continue.
Congressman Andrews, thank you for coming on.
It's my pleasure, Mark. Thanks for having me.
I should say that in the clip, I did mention Mubarak when I meant Musharraf. I don't really often confuse the Egyptian dictator with the Pakistani dictator. I just misspoke there. Now, the part that I think many of you have all been waiting for, where I grill the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, John Conyers. As I explained, I used to sit in the back bench behind John Conyers, and I explained that to him on the air.
To have you here to talk with you. I still remember sitting behind you on those uncomfortable benches that dig into your back on the Judiciary Committee.
Were you in the Senate?
I worked for Barney Frank. I was his counsel.
Right,
in those uncomfortable seats.
You spent many hours agonizing. Do you have a back problem now?
I do. And I blame you. Actually, I blame the Republicans, because they're the ones that gave us that. They were in the majority then. You are chairman now. I don't know. It seems like, is it a greater headache? Because people like me are saying, well, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that?
No, there's the impatience that people have until I remind them that thanks to Newt Gingrich's contract with America, we were out of power for 12 solid, uninterrupted years.
It's true, but we are impatient. Listen, last time we talked, the contempt resolution had not yet gone to the House floor. It now has. It has passed. And, of course, the Bush administration says, we're going to ignore it. We're not going to bring our U.S. attorney in to do anything about it. Now, there's two options left. One, I know you're already doing. You're filing a lawsuit.
But
let's be fair. But the lawsuit, are we going to get this by the time Bush is still in office? I mean, if we win the lawsuit 3 years from now, what have we accomplished?
Well, you're right. If we win it 3 years from now, but if we win it before he goes out of office,
will
that's
we?
A different story.
Will we?
Well, that depends on the judge.
Who's the judge? Do we know yet?
The judge has been determined. I just can't remember his name.
Do you remember whether he's a Bush appointee or a Clinton appointee? Do we have a chance with this
judge? Let me put it like this. He was somebody that when they called his name, I did not jump up and down with joy.
Uh-oh. So it sounds like not a good sign. Okay, so here's the problem, all right? Contempt is vital. I mean, here we are finally saying the president has got to listen to congressional oversight. The Constitution depends on it. For 7 years, he stonewalls. Now you finally hold him in contempt with the Democrats in power, and I'm afraid by the time you get a lawsuit or get up there, you know what I'm going to. The inherent power of contempt, 1934. You know you have the power to do it. Do you have the votes to do it?
Absolutely not.
You don't?
No. But look, Levine, you are a good lawyer. Let me tell you this. This isn't the first time the law has not worked smoothly or effectively.
Nor the hundredth.
Nor the thousandth.
Exactly.
But here is what. We have, first of all, thrown down a marker to, on behalf of every committee in the House and the Senate, to say, if you will not respond voluntarily to the only way we have of oversighting and progressing on our legislative goals, you will be brought against your will in to testify under oath, subject to perjury, and also it's also a felony to commit perjury before a House, even
you
if you're
can
not
see enough. Why Americans who support everything you're doing say it's not enough, because these people will go out of office without ever having any congressional oversight. And as much as you're doing the right thing and Henry Waxman is doing the right thing and bringing people on, without contempt, it's mostly meaningless, isn't it?
Not so fast, Mark Levine. It is not the case. There are plenty of things that can be done between not only now and January 09, but even after it. There is constitutional authority that says impeachment, if that's what you're working toward.
I didn't say that, the I word.
I know.
I said contempt.
I just contempt, all right. But we can take, there's things we can do.
What can you do?
Before and after. First of all, if we're investigating something in which violations of the federal criminal code have occurred, the statute of limitations doesn't expire when you leave office. Number two,
Does that include contempt? Does that include refusing to give your committee the documents you demanded?
Oh, absolutely.
So you think you could put Harriet Myers in jail maybe 2-3 years from now, but it could happen?
Inherent contempt, which you know, apparently you know quite a bit about.
I've been studying.
Except that the only one thing I regret is that the slammer, the prison underneath the chambers,
which used to exist,
it's been sealed off.
But couldn't the sergeant at arms hold someone in your office?
That's right.
I mean, it seems to me that if you just hold Harriet Myers in your office for 2 hours,
24 hours,
you could make a huge difference in protecting the Constitution for the rest of American history.
Well, we already
you
have.
You can feed her. I mean, I'm not, you
That's
know,
right.
I don't
We're
want
human.
To torture.
We want humane.
I want humane, but I want to lock her up.
Treatment.
Exactly.
You want her, do you,
would is that
you,
too much to ask?
Would you prefer that the sergeant of arms bring her to the chamber, the floor of the chamber in handcuffs?
Yeah, I think that's appropriate.
Front or back?
The perk walk.
Yeah, the
back. You know, again, I don't think it's too much to ask. It's about respecting the congressional right under Article 1 to have oversight.
Exactly.
And I'll tell you something. If she did the perk walk, again, you only need 24 hours, you would get the documents you need.
You're probably right. But could I...
Who do you have to convince?
Can I point out to some modest success that we've had already?
All right, go ahead.
Well... We've had her held in contempt by the whole Congress, not just me.
Yeah, I know, but those are words. She won't do anything until she does the perp walk. She won't. Do you think she's going to cave in?
Because I don't. It puts everybody in the country on notice that you have to obey the process of the legislative branch of
Why?
The federal government.
It's toothless. Why should she obey? Yes, you have this wonderful contempt motion.
Well, I would not advise people to get found in contempt of Congress. That does nothing for your reputation as brilliant as yours is. You don't want to be held in contempt of Congress. No matter what happens, whether you're brought in against your will by the sergeants of arms of the House of Representatives.
Let me wish you well in ratcheting it up and hopefully getting more
you're
of
You're racing votes. Against the clock.
I know you are. I know you are. That's why I don't trust the court proceedings, because of the clock. Otherwise,
right.
If you had 5 years, I'd say that's the rule.
Right.
But I hope you can get those votes. I would bet you have the majority of Democrats on your side. You just need a few more. Maybe if my listeners were to call their member of Congress and ask them to support inherent contempt, would that help you out?
I don't want it to be heard that I was urging you to have...
Oh, I'm going to do it with or without you.
No, that you... That I was a party to you urging tens of thousands of people to swamp the telephone lines of the Congress to get them to do what you and I want them to do.
Okay. Well, I will urge it with or without your support. Thank you so much for coming here on the Inside.
I'm honored to be with you again.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, you heard him. You heard what he had to say. If tens of thousands of Americans would swamp the phone lines, they could uphold the Constitution. He said he doesn't have the votes right now to do inherent contempt. Those of you that want impeachment, that want to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney, understand this is far less, but it's a very important step. There is no way you could even come close to impeaching the President and Vice President of the United States unless at the very least you manage to require them to obey Congress. If they refuse to obey Congress, forget impeachment. Now, there are a number of subpoenas that have been issued. As you know, or you may know, Harriet Myers, the former counsel to the president who was actually appointed to the Supreme Court at one point, she refuses to obey. She says to Congress, I don't care about the Constitution. I don't care about Congress. I don't obey the law. I was going to be Supreme Court justice. I have no respect for the law. I follow my president as if he were the Fuhrer. Congress has a right and a duty and responsibility to force the president to obey the law. You heard the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, John Conyers. Right now, he doesn't have the votes, but he does have the power. The power to hold the president's people in inherent contempt. And he said to me, you heard it, that I was probably right. If you make Harriet Myers do the perp walk, what happens? She then obeys the law. So how do we make this happen? You pick up the phone, you dial the Capitol switchboard, 202-225-3121, and you can take your Constitution back. This is Mark Levine, signing off. Thank you.
Powerful. That was a good show.
Thank you.